Hello, everybody, and welcome to I Eat Green. You're listening to Bhavani, and I am thrilled to be here with you on the Progressive Radio Network. I have a wonderful show planned for all of you today. My guest is Kelly McClinchy. She is the Director of Food Education for Butterbeans, Inc., which is a wonderful school lunch wellness company cooking up some meals for some of the schools in New York City, and I'm really excited to have her on and tell us more about what she's doing there in just a little bit. But first, of course, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the city and in our local area and even a little outside of our area, places you might want to take a trip to this summer, like Denver, and I'll tell you about that in just a little bit. And, of course, I share a recipe with all of you. So welcome. It is a beautiful, beautiful Thursday morning, and the sun is shining here in New York, and my gardens are aching for me to come out and do some work. Everything in the last week with all the rain that we've been having is just bursting, and it is really calling to me. And it's hard to sometimes be indoors and do all the things you have to do when every time you pull into your driveway and onto your property, you see all the things that need to happen. But patience, as Michelle Pascal said weeks ago, just breathe like the mountain and you'll get to all of it all. So some of the really exciting things going on in and around the city coming up. There are library workshops that I've told you about over the last couple of weeks that are being funded by the Cornell Cooperative Extension. And they do this throughout the year to educate people, mostly in underserved communities, about eating healthy. So check those out. They're on my website. All of these things are on my website, so you can find out more about them. Slow Food New York City is hosting food waste, food rescue panel discussion. It's an enlightened eaters panel discussion at God's Love We Deliver. That's also being co-hosted by the James Beard Foundation and the Natural Gourmet Institute. And that's at God's Love We Deliver, which is a great nonprofit organization. I've had people on from that organization on this on this radio show. And it should be a great evening. So that's April 20th, if you can make it. Also on April 20th, out on Long Island at Stony Brook's Student Center, they are having a Standing Rock musical performance. And that should be really great. A few members of the Indigenous Standing Rock group are part of this group. And it's a full band, and they will be playing and talking about what's going on at Standing Rock. It's free. It's open to the public. It's from 3 to 5 p.m. in the afternoon of April 20th. If you live out that way and can make it, it should be a great event. April 22nd, as we all know, is Earth Day, and New York City is having a rally to stop Trump's climate agenda, and that's a worthwhile thing to go to if you cannot get to Washington, D.C. for the huge March for Science. And it just seems like there's a continuous onslaught of marches to address what's going on in our current administration. And this is a call out to everybody listening that we all need to participate in some of these. I mean, we can't all go to all of them, but we all need to take a stand and stand up to our democracy and to our equal rights and to our freedoms that we've become used to, because it's scary. I mean, I went and saw a documentary, actually 1984, not a documentary, but the movie 1984 last week. And it's just scary seeing some of the perils of what's going on now and this movie. So we just need to stay vigilant to protect our rights. And March for Science is in support of scientists who are talking about climate change and GMOs and fracking and what's going on with science and how so many of the people in charge in Washington now are science deniers. So if you can make it to that, please come out and show your support. April 23rd, River Woman and River Keeper are having a special event featuring artists at the gallery, Odetta Gallery, and it's River Women Exhibition, and that should be an interesting art show. April 25th is the Tribeca Film Festival, and there's a screening of Intent to Destroy, which is Joe Berlinger's film, and it's about the Armenian genocide. Should be a great event, but there's so many films at the Tribeca Film Festival, so many that deal with food, so check out the lineup there. April 27th, the impact of New York City's school gardens. This is a New York City Food Policy Center healthy breakfast conference, and it's Thursday, April 27th. These are free panels that they have on a regular basis, usually monthly, sometimes bi-monthly, from 8:30 to 10:15 in the morning up at Hunter College on 3rd Avenue at 119th Street. And they're great. I've gone to many of them, and they're very thought-provoking, and they have great speakers. So I recommend coming to that. April 27th, there's a fundraiser for Food Tank, and this should be a lot of fun. It's a dance workout at the Highline Ballroom, and they're expecting hundreds of people to come out and do this new fitness program, dancing. And there's just an article in the New York Times, Science Times, about how dancing is so good for your mental health, better than walking, better than running. So come dance and support Food Tank, which is a wonderful nonprofit organization promoting all the things that Slow Food really promotes, which is good, clean, and fair food. April 29th is the People's Climate March, also in Washington, D.C. And that, in 2014, there was a huge one in New York City with close to 1 million people, if not over 1 million people. And this one is set to be really huge. Very often there's sister marches around the country. I know that there is going to be a sister march on Staten Island. I don't know if there's also going to be a sister march in central New York City. I'm hoping so, because I can't get to Washington, D.C. that evening or that day, but I am available in New York City, so I'm hoping there's a sister march. So stay tuned for that. As soon as I hear about it, I will share that with you. Also on that day is the Sheep Shearing Festival up at Stone Barns, which is a great annual event. It sells out every year, so I don't know if there's still tickets available, but if you're interested in going up there during the day with your kids, it's a great kid event. May 4th, there's a sustainable film series out here at Molloy College, and this film is called Plastic Paradise, and is a documentary film, you know, that includes scientists, researchers, and people just trying to shed light on the effects of plastic consumption in our society and the damage that's happening to the water and to the soil. So check that out. May 6th, Riverkeeper is having their annual Hudson Sweep, which is a volunteer event to help clean up along the shores of the Hudson River. And that has many different location sites. So you can go onto the riverkeeper.org website to find out more about that. The River Fund, which is an organization that I cook for the homeless, they are having their huge fundraiser on May 10th. So check out the riverfund.org's website to find out more information about that and getting tickets. It's a great organization. This is supporting their cradle to college program. And unlike so many food pantry community organizations, the River Fund really cares about each individual family. They know each family that comes to their pantry personally, and they really support them from the minute they're, you know, these young moms get pregnant and have babies till when these kids are going to college. And they help support them along the way to give them good study habits and, you know, everything that a family needs to raise a healthy child in these challenging times. So they're a great organization, and 2 years ago, I think they had their first graduating class of kids that they sponsored through college. And there's been statistics, you know, there's, you know, so many kids that are trying to go to college and they drop out just because they don't have enough money to even pay for the books. You know, they might have gotten financial aid and just like, you know, the new program to support kids going to college if your parents make under $120,000. But these are kids that don't have money for the books. So even if they get tuition paid for, just a few hundred dollars could be the reason they drop out. And the River Fund is really making a difference in that way. So if you can support them, I'll certainly be there, and I hope to see many of you there. There's so many other events. I don't want to take more time to go over them all, but do check out my website at ieatgreen.com. Go to events and find out about them. But the July Slow Food Nation event that I mentioned at the very beginning is July 14th to 16th in Denver. Slow Food, as many of you that follow me know, is an organization very close to my heart, promoting good, clean, and fair food and the pleasures around the table. And that's a part that I really focus on because I think the power of food, of bringing people together around a convivial table, sharing the joys of good, healthy, clean, real food is just not enjoyed enough in our society. And Slow Food is an organization that really recognizes the need for that and bringing it back. So Slow Food Nation is modeled after Terra Madre, which is the international conference that happens every other year in Turin. And this will be happening in Denver. The whole city will be involved, but there's two main locations. One is the train station, one is the convention center, and there's going to be conferences and workshops and food demonstrations. You know, great people are lined up to be there. So check out the Slow Food USA website for more information, or just actually Google Slow Food Nation. You'll find out more about that. But it should be great. I am definitely planning going to that. And hope to see many of you there. I want to share with you my recipe this week. You know, one of the things that I wrote about this week in my blog was about the article that was in the New York Times about vitamin D deficiency. And, you know, so often we get information about a new medical fad that we're supposed to plug into. You know, in the last couple of years, it's been the vitamin D deficiency, and it seems like everyone's vitamin D deficient, and everyone's supposed to be taking these supplements. And now in this article in the New York Times, they just said, you know, it's not totally true. I mean, a lot of people are being told they're vitamin deficient when they really are not vitamin D deficient. So anyway, there's certain foods you can eat to increase your vitamin D. And mushrooms is one of them. And my recipe this week is a recipe that focuses on mushrooms. This is the hedgehog mushrooms. And it's a new mushroom to me. I had not known about it. And I celebrated a big birthday this past week. And somebody gave me a big bag of hedgehog mushrooms. And great birthday present and inspired this recipe. So I also had with me a big bag of real semolina pasta. You know, these days I'm mostly eating brown rice pasta if I eat pasta. But this is manicotti pasta, which are like fat penne pasta, you know, not quite as big as manicotti, but and they're about an inch and a half long and an inch wide, and they're hollow in the middle, kind of like penne. And so I used that pasta along with the hedgehog mushrooms and came up with this recipe. I'm calling it basically manicotti pasta a la hedgehog mushrooms. What else? And so I had about it was a pound of pasta, and it was probably less than a pound of mushrooms. It was like a half a lunch bag full. It was 2 cups, I think I measured it out, 2 cups of fresh hedgehog mushrooms. You can use other mushrooms instead. They're very similar to, not porcini. I'll tell you in a minute. But anyway, you're going to cook the pasta according to the directions in salted water, and you want the pasta to be al dente. What you also need, as far as the ingredients go, is 1 medium onion that you're going to cut in half and then cut into slivers, one cup of carrots that I diced up, the 2 cups of fresh hedgehog mushrooms, 2 cups of sugar snap peas, a half a cup or so of extra virgin olive oil, 3 tablespoons of minced garlic. Yep, lots of garlic in there. 1/4 cup of white wine, 1/3 cup of fresh Italian parsley chopped, 1/4 cup of pine nuts, and salt and pepper to taste. And if you're eating cheese, you can have some cheese on the side that you can sprinkle on top, either Romano or Parmigiano or something like that. So while the pasta is cooking, you're going to coat the bottom of a wok pan with the olive oil and saute the onions for a few minutes until they become translucent. Then add the carrots and the garlic and cook that up, you know, slowly, but, you know, like a medium heat so that the carrots start to caramelize with the onions. And you're going to cook them until they're soft. Then you're going to add the mushrooms and cook those for 5 minutes until they get soft. Then you're going to add the white wine and the sugar snap peas and cook those for about 3 minutes. And you let the white wine cook down a little bit. Remove the pasta from the water. And I removed the pasta with a big slotted spoon and went right from the pasta water into the wok with the pasta so that the pasta could finish cooking in the wok in all of the flavors of the wine and the garlic. And stir-fried that in the wok with all the vegetables. I added the pine nuts and the parsley and tossed that up. If you need to add a little more olive oil or a little bit more wine for some more liquid, you can do that. You can also add a little, you know, like a 1/4 cup or so of the pasta water to that as well. Add salt and pepper to taste and garnish it with the parsley. And as I said, if you want to serve it with Romano or Parmesan cheese as well, you can do that. And it cooked up really fast. It was easy and delicious. So I highly recommend making this recipe. And as always, after you cook it up, let me know how it was. I'd love to hear from all of you. So it is now my pleasure to introduce my guest this week, Kelly McClinchy. She is the Director of Food Education at Butterbeans, which is a school lunch and wellness company headquartered in New York City. Her background is in sustainability and environmental advocacy, and she's passionate about connecting local and global communities to our ecological landscape that supports food systems, you know, in our local area. And she's served on NGOs with the United Nations, worked on climate change with them, and she's just a real mover and shaker. She's also on the board of Slow Food New York City, and I've met her many times, actually even in Italy, at the Slow Food Terra Madre conference. So it's my pleasure to introduce all of you to Kelly. Kelly, are you with me? Kelly? Hello?
Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Good, how are you?
Good. So I'm so happy to have you on finally.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me, Bhavani.
Sure. Well, it's been a pleasure to watch Butterbeans grow. When I first met you and you first started working with them, they were a very small little startup. And, you know, I wasn't sure if they were going to take off or not. And you certainly took off. And it's really wonderful to see how it's grown and to have you on now to tell us about Butterbeans. So,
thank you so much. Yes, we've definitely grown a lot over the past 9 years now.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been 9 years since you started.
Yeah, so our company was started in 2008 by two moms, one of whom is our current president and CEO, Belinda DiGiambattista, over in Brooklyn. And it started with 20 packed lunches that our two co-founders were packing themselves. And today we serve around 3,000 meals a day across 15 schools in New York City and now New Jersey.
Wow, 3,000 meals a day. So where do you do all the cooking?
So we have a commissary kitchen in Sunnyside, Queens. Our executive chef is based there. He has a team of roughly 8 chefs who are working with him. And our chef goes up to Hunts Point Market twice a week and gets fresh seasonal ingredients, and everything is prepared from scratch in our commercial kitchen over there in Queens and then deliver it out to our various locations across the city.
So it's cooked fresh daily, every day?
We have a production cycle, I guess you could put it, where things are prepared and then sent out so that it's delivered to the school the night before lunch is being served. This way we never have any issues with food being late, given unexpected delays that could come up in New York City traffic jams.
Right,
so yeah,
absolutely.
So everything's prepared fresh on site.
So that means a school needs to have a kitchen to be able to heat everything up. Is that correct? It's not brought
correct.
Hot.
Correct. So we kind of occupy a niche in the school lunch realm in that we often work with schools who have often limited space to be, if they might be interested in the idea of, let's say, building out a kitchen and preparing everything on site, but are logistically or for whatever reason unable or, you know, unprepared to take that giant step. So we offer this happy medium and solution for them where the food is still fresh, you know, prepared from scratch, prepared with a lot of love and care, delivered out to our schools. And then we help the school build out a small pantry kitchen where we'll have a warming oven, you know, some basic counter space for any fresh salad bar prep that might be done for that given school. And then, of course, significant refrigeration to be able to hold everything at temp.
Right. How big is the biggest school that you're serving?
That's a wonderful question. And it's a little bit tricky to answer because some of our schools are growing significantly. So that's part of, you know, our growth is that as our communities grow, we grow with them, and that's really important for us that there's this relationship between, you know, between the school lunch program, our food education programs, and the communities that we serve. We have one school in Brooklyn right now where we serve around 650 meals just at that school. And that's a large school that's growing. We have another school over in New Jersey that has 3 campuses, and that's a significant number over there as well. So, and then we have, you know, some schools that are 80 kids, and those are just as important to us. It's just a different community.
Uh-huh. And does the whole school have to participate in order to have your service?
That's a great question. So it depends on what the school wants. We do have some schools where the lunch program is mandatory, meaning that as part of being a school parent, part of your tuition is that your lunch is included in that. Other schools, we are opt-in, meaning that a parent can choose whether they're going to send their child in with lunch or eat with butter beans each day. So there's a mix there as well. And that just depends on what the school is looking for and what their community is looking for.
Uh-huh. I know, having worked in the school lunch program and then moving my kids to a public school and working on the school cafeteria committee and being involved and knowing how little money is allocated in the public schools towards school lunch, and part of the problem and the reason why the school lunches are so often so poor. Can I ask, how much do you get for a school lunch? I mean, I think the public schools charge like a dollar. They figure $1, $1.20, and it's really hard to put together a good, healthy lunch for that.
Right. It depends. I wish I had a better answer for that, too. It really depends on the school. And we don't serve public schools, and that's because in New York City, the public schools their school lunch programs are operated by the Department of Education here in the city. We do serve private and charter schools, and they have slightly different offerings, based on the community needs, and that obviously affects the price that we're offering. And some schools subsidize the lunch program as well, so that it varies.
Right. Now, if I was to walk into one of the Butterbean cafeterias, what kind of foods would I be likely to see? And do the different schools have preset menus that they choose from? Do you do the same meals for all the different schools? How does that work?
Excellent question also. So I will say part of our model with the commissary kitchen is that we're really leveraging economies of scale by being able to produce all of our meals in one place and then service our schools by getting these meals out to schools across the city. So there are definitely our menu, there are some nuances here and there. For by and large, the schools are getting on a given Monday or Thursday, all of our schools are enjoying the same menu that day. We have a director of community and nutrition on our team who works very closely with our executive chef and takes feedback from our parents and students and teachers all throughout the year to be able to look at our menu and tailor it and change it. So the menu has really evolved quite a lot in the past 5 years to be this product of lots of different perspectives and palates. So on a given day, we always have a meat entree, a vegetarian entree, two vegetable sides on the hot bar, and then we have a cold bar with dozens of different salad topping options, all of which are prepared in our kitchen. So, for example, our broccoli florets, our chef is getting that whole head of broccoli, and his team is preparing it in the kitchen and sending it out to our schools. So everything, the goal is really fresh, seasonal whenever possible, local whenever possible. The main thing being that there are a lot of options, and we're really trying to get kids to understand the importance and the value of making healthy choices as they come through the lunch line.
So when you're delivering the food, you're not delivering individual plates. You're delivering more like chafing pans, and then they set up a buffet line and kids come through the way they would in a public school?
Correct, exactly. So I love what you said before, Bhavani, about conviviality and gathering around the table. And that is definitely a really important value for us, as an organization. The meals are all, as you just said, go out, all of our menu items go out in pans that then get served to the kids by our on-site staff. So each school has a minimum, depending on the school size, at least two up to six staff who are on-site at that school every day, Monday through Friday. That's their home base. They get to know the kids get to know them, and that connection, that relationship, we find really important in just encouraging the kids and giving them the foundation that they need to get excited about healthy food and to come through and build this really beautiful, colorful, bountiful plate that they then sit down at a table with their friends and enjoy. So it's all about, for us, mealtime is a really special and important part of the school day.
Right. So also, I had missed this earlier. I didn't realize that you actually send the staff as well. So it's your staff heating the food up. It's not, kitchen ladies that are not familiar with the food. It's actually people that work for you that know how to heat up the broccoli. Because, that's my thought, of course, is, you might send over some beautiful broccoli florets that are bright green and look delicious. And then, of course, if they sit in a serving, lunch line for hours, they become olive green very quickly and overheated.
Exactly.
And look disgusting. So right. How does your staff do that?
Who's going to eat that? I mean, then you've got the problem, right? I mean, you and I wouldn't want that, right? That's the aesthetic, the beauty, the appeal of food is just as important for kids, if not more so.
More important. They decide,
exactly.
If they're going to eat it the minute they see it before they even taste it. How does it look?
Right.
I mean, I ran a cafeteria for school, at the Waldorf School for 2 years, so I know how that is. So how do you address that?
How do we address the actual look of the food?
Yeah, and the people reheating it and keeping it looking well.
Such a great, very industry-specific question, Bhavani. I love it. Training is so very important to our operations. And our people, you know, like any growing business, they are at the heart of what we do. I can't emphasize enough the importance and value of our team members in actually accomplishing what it is that we've set out to do in terms of connecting kids to healthy, good, nourishing food. It makes all the difference in the world when we have a team in place at a school who can balance the importance of developing those relationships with the kids with the actual tactical operational importance of how to heat up the food, how to keep it at temp, you know, how to make sure that the cold bar and hot bar are replenished consistently. So there's that, it looks appealing as the students are coming through the lunch line. There's this famous, I'm sure you've, you know, encountered this story about the farmers markets, how farmers can't sell one bunch of chard if it's the only bunch of chard on the stand. But if that same bunch is nested with 20 other bunches of chard, it's going to go in a second.
Right.
And that's not dissimilar to what we, you know, to what you're dealing with along the lunch line. So if a delicious burger could be sitting there, a chickpea burger could be sitting there alone versus in a full can, and there's going to be a really different reaction and response to that same food item in those two different scenarios. So training. And making sure that we're, making sure that our people are growing with us, that value of growing as a company translates to our people growing with us and really honing in on what their individual goals are so that we can help support that. And I think one of the beautiful things about Butterbeans is that goal and what we orient ourselves around as individual team members, those goals can change. So if one of our team members is really focused on going back to school and trying to get their undergraduate degree, we are fully behind and want to be supporting that. And I think that environment of support and collaboration and teamwork is really, really key to the environment that we're trying to foster for our team members and not for our school communities.
Yeah, sounds great. And how do you address different food allergies? I know that there's a meat one, there's a vegetarian one. Do you address gluten-free? I would assume you do at this point. Gluten-free
Absolutely.
Or dairy-free?
So there's such a huge range of, as you know better than anyone, of different dietary restrictions and preferences and allergies. And when a parent signs up for our lunch program, we collect all that information. And because we have on-site team members who are, like I said, getting to know these kids, that becomes a fairly quick and easy. We're able to customize the lunch experience for those individuals because we have these wonderful team members on site who can really work with that child and make sure that they're getting fed a meal that is satisfactory and nourishing for that individual child.
Wow, so that's amazing that you can customize for different dietary needs.
It's a feat, but it's important.
yeah, it is. I mean, I know, you know, being in this business, I know what it's like to customize for different people's food allergies, and it's huge, and it's getting huger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting because it's so prevalent in our society, and you go to some other countries, and everybody eats everything, and they don't have all these issues.
Right.
And you wonder, why do we have all these issues, and we're not even going to go there right now. That's a whole different show.
Whole other show, exactly.
Yeah, it's food for thought. But, you know, my question would be if you're trying to keep all the food looking full and beautiful for even that last person coming through the line, what do you then do with the leftovers? How do you address food waste? Because we know, you know, as part of Slow Food, I know you know, and we've been mm-hmm. talking about this so often, how we all can address the problem around food waste.
Absolutely. And you're just making me think, I'm going to give a really quick plug. And actually, you mentioned at the start of the episode, Slow Food NYC, we're hosting a food waste panel next Thursday, just 2 days before Earth Day. So this topic is really important right now. And it's been kind of amazing to me to watch how food waste has become almost a trending subject in the food world, increasingly so over the past year and a half. And I think people are really starting to, partially because of this media attention, pay attention to it, which is good because it's not just, there's so many subjects that it touches upon. We've got some of the, you know, highest obesity rates of this century right now in our kids. And yet we also have incredible rates of hunger, throughout the country. And there's some estimates say 40% of food is wasted in the United States. So there's this huge dichotomies and seeming contrast in our conflicts in our food system right now. So food waste is an incredibly important subject. And then as a business, that's obviously also has economic significance. We are putting a lot of resources into the creation of that meal, both purchasing the ingredients to the actual labor of preparing that meal, getting it out to the school, right? There's a lot of energy and resources going into that final product and a lot of love and care. So seeing it thrown out is the last thing that we want. Now, that said, there's got to be a balance because, as you're saying, we never want a child to not, to come through the line and not have food. So we have a really a very specific feedback mechanism for our inventory that's grown, with the company over the past 9 years. So for every single menu item, our supervisors every single day are going in and saying, here's how much we received, here's how much was left over, if at all. And this way, for the next time that menu item is served, our chef has this incredible wealth of information to be able to say, okay, I'm going to send a little bit less or a little bit more or, whatever the need might be for that specific community. And again, that's really very much a product of having the right person in place at our schools who can go in and be thinking big picture here about about what their school needs. So that's definitely a really important to us for so many reasons.
Yeah. It really is because, again, from my experience working in the school lunch program, what a first grader needs and what they're going to eat is very different than what an 11th grader or 12th grader is going to eat. And sometimes, the school
different
lunch program
appetite.
Is like, okay, a portion is 3 chicken nuggets. I'm talking about in the public school lunch program. And it doesn't matter if you're a first grader or you're an 11th grader. And how can they expect that to fill up 11th grader? And it might be too much for a first grader. So, I always... it was actually included in my blog this week of, at a Seder, a way to keep down the food waste is to, let people come through the buffet and take what they think they're going to eat instead of everybody getting served a plate full of food when half the people cannot eat all that food. And then you're going to have it, once it's on someone's plate, it becomes food waste. So, really customizing the quantity, so I don't know if kids come through the line, can they say, can I have a little more? Can I have, that's too much? Or is there a set portion, like one scoop is this, portion and do the portion sizes change depending on the age group you're working with?
We definitely portion and it's going to be a little bit different. Certainly, with one school where we're serving pre-K through 10th grade. And so, yes, they're definitely getting different. The pre-K and K lunches actually go out in carts at a couple of our schools to the classroom. And our servers are being very specific about what they're serving to those classrooms because a five-year-old is going to be eating a very different plate, obviously, than a 15-year-old. So in the lunchroom, what we do is we have all the kids come through once, They walk through the line, they get a full plate, and then if they're still hungry, they can come back up for seconds. So that's, you know, we also don't want folks to, for their, you know, to take more than they're actually going to eat. So that, that exercise is coming through once, and then again, if you're still hungry, is also really important for reducing food waste and making sure that the students are leaving lunch feeling happy and full.
Right. Excellent. Excellent. Kelly, let's take a couple minute break. And when we come back, I want to actually address another aspect of your business, which is education. I know Butterbeans really gets involved in actually teaching the kids as well. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Kelly McClinchy from Butterbeans, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. We'll be right back.
Most news anywhere on the internet. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, your number one source for everything progressive.
Hi, I'm David Crow, host of The Infectious Myths, Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time here on PRN.FM. I love science the way it should be practiced, but a lot of modern science is corrupted by financial interests and serves a master other than the public good. Myths continue to be constructed around viruses, vaccines, forensics, and pharmaceutical drugs. People are dying and ending up in jail because of them. Listen to me as I deconstruct the myths that those who call themselves scientists weave, or when I wander into social and political topics. If you're new to the show, check out our past episodes at infectiousmyth.podbean.com.
Keep listening to PRN. The Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm talking with Kelly McClinchy from Butterbeans, which is a school lunch program located in New York City, and they deliver healthy school lunches to charter schools and private schools. So, Kelly, right before the break, I wanted to touch on the education piece. How does Butterbeans get involved in educating kids about healthy food?
That is a wonderful question, and it's at the heart of what we do, as you mentioned earlier. The food education has been a stalwart of the program since the very beginning. When the company first started, that manifested in cooking classes. So we would host, and we still do to this day, after school cooking classes as part of the offerings or services for the schools that we worked with. Today, we service on average a dozen schools across the city with an after school program. And those cooking classes are very hands-on. The kids are involved with preparing a meal from start to finish. So taking the whole ingredient, transforming them into a delicious meal. And then, again, you know, most importantly, having time at the end of the class to sit down together, say thank you to the farmers and the chefs who helped prepare that meal that day, and enjoy a tasty, you know, a tasty meal that they put a lot of effort into. And, you know, just zooming out for a moment, the educational piece for how, in terms of school lunch, is really important in getting the kids to feel engaged and to feel excited about healthy, nourishing, seasonal meals. And I think, you know, you've put this really well before, Bhavani. It's not dissimilar to the appearance of food. If a child has some kind of stake in the preparation of a meal, or they know firsthand what goes into the preparation of a meal, they're going to have a lot more buy-in into trying something. And I think that's the biggest, you know, for both school lunch and our food education program. It's really important and wonderful and celebrated when our kids that are working with, just taste something. It's okay if they don't love it. It's okay if it's not their favorite thing. The most important element is that they tasted it. And education in terms of actual cooking can go a really long way in helping that.
You know, you just made me think of something when you were talking about kids tasting and having better buy-in. When they come through the lunch line, if something doesn't look so good to them, can they just take a little taste of something?
Absolutely. So, I mean, that's part of the food education, right? So we provide our staff with sample cups at each of our school locations. So they're little 1-ounce tasting cups. And this way, particularly for the younger ones, if they're not so sure about that Israeli couscous or the butternut squash dip, our staff can present them with a small little sample, which for some kids just, it's a little bit more approachable. They feel more comfortable having that small bite and that encouragement from our team to say, that's awesome that you tried that just now. That is wonderful. And, you know, it's all right that you didn't like it. And maybe next time you will.
Uh-huh. One thing that I love to tell kids, and, you know, I do it all the time because it really opens them up, is I talk to them about how, you know, as you get older and your body changes, you know, and you know, your feet grow bigger and your hands grow bigger and you get taller, well, your tongue is also changing. And so your taste buds are all over your tongue. And what you don't like when you're 2, you might like when you're 5. And what you don't like when you're 5, you might like, you know, you ever wonder why all of these adults eat all these different foods that you don't eat? You know, when I was a kid, I didn't like goat cheese. I didn't like mushrooms, you know. And then as you get older, your taste buds change. So I tell them to always, even if you didn't like it last year, you want to try it again, because every time you like a new food, you can get excited that you're getting older, your tongue is changing, and, you know, and kind of present it like that. And they really like that idea.
Absolutely. I think we need to have you come into some of our cooking classes, Bonnie.
I would love to. So do you address seasonality or food sustainability at all in your cooking classes or in your conversations with the schools?
Yep, definitely. That's kind of the fun of the food education department and our programs there. We have a lot more opportunity to actually have conversations with the kids. You know, school lunch is, the goal is to get the kids to have lunch, right? They need to, there's a whole timing element that also would probably be a whole other show to school lunch, that, you know, that really makes just getting all the kids to the lunch line sometimes the biggest priority. So when we have kids in an after school cooking class, or we come in and do a guest workshop during the school day, or even better, we run a food and garden summer camp that will be in its 7th year this year, and it's actually a full day camp. So we have kids with us from 9 to 4, Monday through Friday, going on farm-to-table adventures across the city. So we're taking them to the farmer's market. They are churning ice cream on a bicycle-powered ice cream machine, or meeting with chocolatiers in the West Village, or visiting rooftop farms in Brooklyn. And these experiences, these really hands-on, tangible experiences, allow us to have, you know, more time and thus deeper conversations with the students we're working with about how food grows, where it grows, who grows it, what goes into growing that food, all, you know, just the endless opportunities for really substantive topics around food sustainability, seasonality, nutrition, health, and wellness.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure seasonality comes in play with the chefs. I mean, it might not be talked about, but I'm sure if they're shopping at the local farmer's market or even Hunts Point Market, I mean, there's, you know, asparagus are coming into season now, so they're probably on the menus where you're not going to have asparagus, you know, necessarily in the winter.
Definitely. And, you know, we try our best. It's not always completely seasonal or local, the menu. You know, I think one of the biggest takeaways that I've personally valued from our company rhetoric and, you know, what we aim to do is that you have to meet people where they're at. Our CEO is very fond of saying that, and it's true. You know, in order to push some of these, you know, what you and I talk about all the time in the slow food world too, push this agenda and rhetoric around good, clean, and fair food for everyone. There's got to be a foundation that people can feel comfortable approaching. And when you have that foundation and that comfort level, that really allows you to take someone to the next level. So maybe a child is, you know, it's a big deal for them to be enjoying that brown rice, and that's great, and that's a step to celebrate. And if we can get them to have that seasonal asparagus soup as the next step in the spring, fabulous. And that's sort of our thinking around balance in the menu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. You know, and I think, like you said, with slow food, it's one of the things that I do love about the slow food movement is that it recognizes that, you know, everyone's not going to be a vegetarian or eat a certain way, but if you meet them where they are, they can at least do better in what they do eat, making those better food choices. If you're going to eat meat, you want to support the farmer that's raising animals the proper way. If you're going to, you know, eat dairy, you want to know that those animals are eating organic grain and not GMO food, and that they're grazing and that they're happy, you know, so that, because that translates into the quality of the food you're getting.
Correct. And the quality of the experience, and there's connections to the environment and a healthy economy. I mean, there's so many touch points there. And I think, you know, I think the school lunch arena and the food education field has really been a reflection of how of public interest growing in this area. I mean, there's something like over 65 nutrition education organizations in New York City right now alone. Columbia University, their teachers college over there, has been doing a study to just try and assess the nutrition education landscape in New York City, because it's grown so much in the past 5 years. You know, there was a time when for example, slow food was the player here in New York City. And again, just looking at butter beans over the past 9 years, the way that parents and families perceive the menu that we're putting forth is vastly different. You know, even in just the past 3 or 4 years, that's changed.
In what way?
People understand it more. They're looking for it. And that's exciting.
Mhm. Mhm. Yeah, absolutely. And have you found it helpful to cultivate partnerships with other organizations such as Slow Food with Butterbeans to get your message out?
I think that we do that mostly through our educational programs. So as I mentioned before, with our summer camp as an example, partnerships with other good food businesses is really important and a really valuable part of the experience for our kids. You know, they're cooking with us every day as part of the camp experience. And then 3 to 4 days of the week, we actually take them to go meet these experts in the field, whether it be a gelato shop or a chocolate maker or a farmer or a gardener, you know, or a chef. Those partnerships with local businesses is really valuable to the educational experience. And then more broadly, I mean, you and I have interacted through the slow food space, right? I think there's a lot of beauty and positive things that can come out of this collaboration across organizations. You know, I think we're all better off working together in a lot of ways. And sharing ideas when it comes to curriculum and tactics on how to get a child to eat the broccoli florette. Because it is a new, you know, this is new. This is something that's growing a lot, as is exemplified just in butter beans. And I think we as individuals in the food space are defining this field right now. It's happening right now. And I think that coming together and collaborating can only be beneficial.
Mm-hmm. And with the hands-on education program that you have in the summer, and you know, with the students that you're working with, have you come across any like great aha moments that you might want to share before we run out of time? We're almost at the end of our program.
I have two very quick stories that I love to share. One is when I was actually teaching. So I started with Butterbean teaching after school classes, and we had just finished up a meal. I think it was a six parts of the plant salad. And this little six-year-old girl raises her hand. She's raising it in the air and waving it around, so excited to share something. And she says, Miss Kelly, I just realized something. We're all like the ingredients in this meal. When we come together, we make something beautiful. This moment I'll never forget, this six-year-old sharing this really gorgeous thing. And then another class, one five-year-old who was just notorious for couldn't sit still, always running around, getting up and out of his seat, dancing, you know, just you would think he was not actually paying attention to the class. One day shared with one of my educators, they were reviewing kale or something like this, and he said, oh, this kale is a cousin of the broccoli. They're in the brassica family. And it was just a lesson of you never know what a child is picking up and listening to, even though
isn't that amazing?
It's truly astounding. And wonderful.
Right, because when I started doing this, you know, all the talk was how few kids even know what a potato is. I mean, you show them a potato and they think it's a rock.
Exactly.
You know, and so then to be able to know, you know, that broccoli and cauliflower are in the same family, that's like night and day, right?
Mind-blowing and really great.
Well, that's great. Kelly, just really quickly, you want to share Butterbean's website and how people can find out more about Butterbean's before we end?
Absolutely. You can find us at butterbeanskitchen.com or on social media at Butterbeans, Butterbeans Kitchen on Instagram. And we look forward to hopefully having some guests of your show come cook with us sometime soon.
Great. Well, I'm really so happy to have you on. I'm so happy actually to have watched Butterbean's grow because, you know, like I said, when I first heard about you guys and met you, you know, you were really small and, you know, I've seen many small companies come and go, unfortunately, because they couldn't really make it work. And it's really exciting to see that you've taken off and you're working and you're serving these great meals to kids in the city, and it's just wonderful. So thank you for what you do. And everybody out there, thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green. All of the information about Butterbeans you'll be able to find also on my website at ieatgreen.com. And thank you, everyone. Have a great rest of the week. Thank you, Kelly, again. And bye for now. You're welcome. I'll see you all next week. Bye now.